And another study caught our attention this week, the annual Gallup poll, which found that half of all Americans have a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in the news media. That's higher than last year, but still far lower than in previous years. In times of national stress, Americans renew the old and durable debate over how far the press ought to go in telling truth to power. We've been passing through one of those times, and another such time occurred during the early days of network TV, the era of Senator Joseph McCarthy and newsman Edward R. Murrow, who waged an epic battle on the small screen.
Our working thesis tonight is this quotation: "If this fight against communism is made a fight between America's two great political parties, the American people know that one of these parties will be destroyed, and the Republic cannot endure very long as a one-party system." We applaud that statement, and we think Senator McCarthy ought to. He said it 17 months ago in Milwaukee.
That was Murrow throwing down the gauntlet in 1954 on his program See It Now. It was an act of considerable coverage depicted powerfully in the new film Good Night and Good Luck, co-written and directed by George Clooney and starring David Strathairn as Murrow. Good Night and Good Luck refers to Murrow's famous sign-off, but in the context of the film, it could also be heard as Murrow's last lingering hope for the future of the nation and for his network, CBS. Among the crusading journalists who then worked at CBS were a group referred to as Murrow's Boys, among them reporter Joe Wirshbaugh, played by Robert Downey in the film. Patricia Clarkson plays his wife Shirley, another CBS producer. The real-life couple consulted on the new film, and they join us now from their home on Long Island. Joe, Shirley, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So this is one evocative film. It's shot in black and white. And, of course, in early 1954, McCarthy's hearings of accused subversives were broadcast. They were the first ever televised hearings, and they were used in the film. So McCarthy essentially plays himself. Murrow, of course, couldn't be depicted by recycling old TV footage, so they have an actor to play him. You knew Murrow. How accurately do you think he was depicted in the film?
If you closed your eyes during the first read-through of the script, I did close my eyes, and I thought I was hearing Murrow.
We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law.
It was unbelievable.
I'll tell you how unbelievable it was. When I first saw Strathairn, I saw him from the back of his head. And I said, "My God, it's Murrow's head." And the minute he opened his mouth and looked towards us, it was Murrow all over again. He didn't try to imitate Murrow. He exuded Murrow.
George Clooney plays the legendary Fred Friendly as a relatively quiet, wry person. He was Murrow's producer. He also functioned in some degree, it seems, as his heat shield.
Fred Friendly was the enforcer. Murrow came up with what he wanted to do with the line that he was taking, and Fred saw to it that all the stuff that we had was edited with that in mind. If anybody ever terrorized people, it was Fred.
I think he wanted Murrow to have all of the attention.
One thing I noticed was that during Murrow's broadcasts, we see Fred Friendly literally crouched at his feet, obscured partly by his desk, and he cued Murrow by tapping a pen on Murrow's knee. And he lit Murrow's cigarettes during the taped segments, speaking quietly, still crouched there. Was that what it was really like?
Yes, exactly. That was the way he cued Murrow to start, because they were in very, very tight quarters. As a matter of fact, some of the people who saw a screening of it, people like Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather and Morley Safer and Walter Cronkite, they said they have never seen a newsroom film that was as authentic as this.
Cigarette smoke seems to fill nearly every frame, mostly coming from Murrow's cigarette.
Everybody smoked in those days. I smoked. Joe smoked.
At a time when we went to Korea to cover the Korean War in 52, Ed and I shared a room, and at 4:30 in the morning I would hear a zip, and that was Murrow starting his morning with a cigarette. He was doing a minimum of 2 packs a day, but I think he went up to 4 packs a day.
Yeah, he always had a cigarette.
And he just couldn't be talked out of it until he developed lung disease later on.
And he died of lung cancer in 1964.
Yes, he did. The interesting thing about the crew of actors in the scene is that I don't think any of them smoke. And here they had to. But I know they were not inhaling. They were just puffing it out. And when George Clooney learned from Ruth Friendly that Fred Friendly had never smoked, he was so relieved because he's not a smoker. He didn't have to smoke, but everybody else did.
I want to move to the political environment now, and I'm talking about politics with a big P and politics with a small p. In terms of office politics, there was a rule that professional colleagues at CBS weren't allowed to marry.
You weren't allowed to be in the company if you had a relative there, whether it was a cousin, an uncle, a sister, and certainly you couldn't be married.
Well, what's a fancy word for that kind of a situation?
Nepotism.
Well, that was supposed to be nepotism at $45 a week, and it was a big word to spread over $45.
We knew that one of us would have to quit. As a matter of fact, the boss at the time said he thought that we ought to get married, and I said, well, we would, except I don't want to quit working. So he said, well, don't tell anybody about it. I'll try to clear it with personnel, which he never did, so we had to keep it a secret.
So did you really take off your wedding rings before you went to work?
Absolutely. Joe actually didn't wear one. But I put it on a gold chain around my neck, and I always had high neck blouses.
Let me move on to William Paley. He ran the CBS network for what, about 50 years?
Well, he started it.
He's depicted by Frank Langella as a figure who is as huge and immovable as the Washington Monument. What role did he play in the real-life drama?
Bill Paley created the Columbia Broadcasting System. He backed the best news and news people that he could find. Murrow was his boy.
And his friend.
And his friend. There was a rarity for anybody to be Bill Paley's friend who wasn't a member of the family.
Okay, but we see in the film a rather testy exchange between Murrow and Paley.
It got to that stage only because Murrow and Friendly were not going to quit cold on the stories that they did. Paley knew that they weren't going to quit, and I thought that it was a fair shake that somebody should know that going on the air with an attack on McCarthy, this was breaking the rule which Paley and Murrow themselves had set up, which could lead to closing down the whole news business.
Somebody is going to go down. Have you checked your facts? Are you sure you're on safe ground?
Bill, it's time. Show our cards.
My cards. You lose, what happens? Five guys find themselves out of work. I'm responsible for a hell of a lot more than five goddamn reporters. Let it go.
You could tell that a lot of the people were worried stiff about what the consequences of this program would be, and Murrow caught that and said, Terra is right here in this room. And then he followed up with another line, which unfortunately is not in the script, but I remember it, and I couldn't have made it up myself. No one man can terrorize a whole nation unless we are all his accomplices.
You know, in the end, it wasn't politics, but bottom line pressures that compelled Paley to act and essentially push Murrow off of his primetime perch.
Well, you know, Paley, I think he once said his sorriest day was when he went public with the company, because then he had to answer to the economic pressures that would come from shareholders. You had to turn a profit. I think Paley, given his druthers, would have gone along with Murrow all the way.
You know, you two have in the film an exchange in bed one night. Mm. It's of such critical dramatic significance, I kind of thought it was added by the writers. Joe, you sort of muse, what if we meaning Murrow's boys, are wrong? What if there are communists out there poised to take down our government? And you said, what if we're protecting the wrong people? Did that exchange happen?
Not really. We talked about not so much were we wrong, but were we doing the right thing? Because we grew up in this atmosphere of you don't take sides. You just present the news straight. That was the discussion that Joe and I used to have. Should we break with it? And I can remember that thought in particular. You've got to do it. You've got to go with this program, or else what happens to the country? Also, he did offer McCarthy equal time to answer.
Some say that the wise, deadpan news anchor of old is passing out of time. Some of them see this as the model of the Murrow tradition, but actually, if you look at the film, Murrow wasn't the very model of the objective opinion-free anchor. His legend is built on when he took a stand. Nowadays, that would be seen as questionable journalism, and I don't think he'd last long in the anchor chair.
Well, he wouldn't be doing it every night or every week. It was on very, very special occasions. If you recall, Walter Cronkite stepped out behind that wall of impartiality when he said the Vietnam War was unwinnable. On rare occasions, if someone you respect who has been impartial, if he or she should say, there is only one side here, I will give it to you, and then it's up to your audience to make the decision.
I must tell you that Murrow agonized over what right did he have to use the whole power of a network to go against one man. And the answer to that is, that man, is strong enough to take care of himself. And that's where that line from Shakespeare comes in.
Earlier the senator asked, upon what meat does this our Caesar feed? Had he looked three lines earlier in Shakespeare's Caesar, he would have found this line, which is not altogether inappropriate. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. No one familiar with the history of this country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating, but the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly.
Right after he came out of the studio, having done the McCarthy broadcast, I knew I was going to be having children, and I said, Ed, if it's a boy, I'm going to name him after you. And he answered, do you think it was worth it? And I said, it has to be.
Did you name your child after him?
I did.
So you guys didn't take your work home.
We lived our work.
Between them, Joe and Shirley Wershbaugh have spent many decades toiling in network news. We reach them at their home on Long Island.
Whatever happens in this whole area of the relationship between the individual and the state, we will do it ourselves. It cannot be blamed on Malenkov or Mao Zedong or even our allies. And it seems to us, that is, Fred Friendly and myself, that this is a subject that should be argued about endlessly. Good night. And good luck.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff, Sarah Dalsimer, Derek John, and David Ocasio. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting Lang Lang, performing Chopin's first piano concerto with the New York Philharmonic under music director Lauren Mazel, on Live from Lincoln Center, sponsored by MetLife, airing September 22nd on PBS, and the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.